Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I'm thrilled to have Mark Whitaker on the show today. Mark is Executive Director of the T-Factor Initiative at Coca-Cola Consolidated. Mark, I am so excited. I'm excited about people hearing your story. I'm just excited about reconnecting with you because you and I first met several years ago when you were the keynote speaker for the annual prayer breakfast here. And I came up to you afterwards and we talked. So I'm excited about reconnecting. I'm excited about our listeners hearing this story. And the cool thing about it is you're in Charlotte and I'm in St. Louis.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited about being on the show. I remember that prayer breakfast very well in 2014.
Yeah. I didn't remember exactly when it was. I just remember you made an impression on me. So I know that you will make an impression on our listeners too. But let's just kind of take it back to just when you grew up. Tell us a little bit about that story. And then we've got a lot of things I want to talk about.
Yeah, I grew up just north of Cincinnati, near Kings Island Amusement Park, about 30 minutes north of Cincinnati. Wonderful parents. My mom's still living, 87. My dad passed 3 years ago at 90. Just wonderful parents. Two brothers and a sister, so three other siblings. Only one out of four that went to college. And I went to Ohio State University, got a bachelor's and master's and a PhD in biochemistry from Cornell. And my mom used to say, I went and got a degree for all of them.
So I have to ask you, though, biotech, biochemistry, was there a precipice for that? Did you have a teacher that inspired you? I mean, you know, that was kind of a different kind of degree to get. I mean, it's a great degree, as we're going to talk about, but what inspired you to do that?
Yeah, we had a guest speaker when I was in eighth grade that was from the biotech industry and talked about how the biotech industry was booming. And it did boom. I graduated in 83 from Cornell. And that's right when Genentech was coming about and the whole biotech boom. But it was kind of that platform was being prepared shortly before that. And I can remember as far back as eighth grade. And I remember telling my parents that I'm looking to possibly get a PhD in biochemistry. And they said, what? You know, I'm maybe 13 years old at the point.
Well, I think you picked right. And I'm so glad you were listening that day.
Yeah.
I mean, you did go to Cornell. And I remember reading, Mark, you were the youngest PhD in biotech when you graduated with a PhD.
Yes, I was. Now, that's long ago in 83, but I was at the time. I was 22 years old when I was a PhD student already. The average was closer to 32 during that time when I was there. So yeah, 22 is fairly young for that. I graduated at 25, and most of them would be about mid-30s. With a PhD in chemistry.
Just amazing. I love that, though, that you were in eighth grade and you said, that's what I'm going to do. And by George, you did. There had to be some other things going on with you, Mark, like determination and grit that I'm sure that we can talk about.
Yeah, I was pretty ambitious. And I think that ambition was good. But I think it was also kind of part of my challenges, too, and part of some downfalls that I've had in life. Sometimes you can be overambitious. And I think I did go through spells of that, not in college, but there were seasons that overambition was a downfall for me.
You know, not to dive too deeply into this, but I was just reading something this morning and it said that it used to be that people would be like, they wanted to work hard because they wanted to make a lot of money. In fact, young people often say, yeah, I want to make a lot of money. But, you know, we can talk about that. But I think the tide is turning a little bit because I think people realize that money is not everything and money really cannot buy happiness. So, you know, going on into your career, you started your career here in St. Louis, and that's what a lot of people may not know about you.
Yeah, I did. I remember Ralston Purina. It was its own independent company then. It wasn't a part of Nestle's. And I remember them recruiting me. I talked to several different companies in Cornell campus. And I recall Ralston Purina coming to recruit me. And I started with them right when I graduated in 1983. I came there to Ralston Purina on Checkerboard Square, downtown St. Louis. And my wife was working for a South African plant researcher at the Botanical Gardens.
Oh, okay. Very good. Now, you guys, you and Ginger were married at the time when you came to St. Louis?
We did. When we finished our degrees in Ohio State, we got married before I went to Cornell in New York. We got married. So okay. She was 20 and I was 21 at the time.
Hey, you guys were high school sweethearts, weren't you?
Yeah, even junior high. We met when she was seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. Went to our proms together. I was senior class president. She was treasurer of her class. And like I said, it was a very healthy ambition at that point, but I kind of lost some of that healthy ambition where we're a little bit on overdrive later in life.
Right. And we see that happen. And so we can certainly talk about that. But so you were at Ralston and you were there for how long, Mark?
I was there about 2 years and I was doing some work. I spoke fluent German. Cornell required a second language and I learned German. And we were actually doing some work for another company called Degussa in Frankfurt, Germany. And they hired me and moved me to Germany for 4 years at their world headquarters. It was a big promotion for me, brought me to a vice president level. And I was only 27, 4 years in Germany at their world headquarters. They had about 50,000 employees. And then I was 2 years in New York with them, 4 years in Germany and 2 years in New York. So about 6 years with them.
27 years old. And you knew everything there was to know, I'm sure.
Yeah, I thought I did.
So you ended up with ADM. Were you a divisional president at 32?
Yes, divisional president and corporate vice president of the company and divisional president of the biotech division.
Yes, 30,000 employees.
Yes.
Huge company, right?
$70 billion in revenue, number 56 on the Fortune 500.
Number 56. And at 32, you were the divisional president and then the VP over the company. And I know, Mark, you were pulling down a lot of money. $3 million a year, I think, is what you were pulling down.
Well, with the stock options, bonuses, the base salary was much less than that, but the total compensation was in that $2 to $3 million a year every year for the 8 years that I was there.
32 years old.
And that would have been 1989. Think about that. 30 years ago, that salary level.
I mean, anybody that's put in that position would be maybe a little bit shaken. But
I thought I was Bon Jovi. I really did.
Yeah. So let's talk about what happened. And I'm not going to take this out of your mouth. You tell me the story and what happened with the price fixing. And then your precious wife, Ginger, who I just love because I'm just like, wow, what an awesome wife. I mean, in a way, right? It's kind of a hard thing, I know.
Well, basically, when I was at Degussa, for the 6 years at Degussa, I was over joint ventures and acquisitions and mergers, and I was doing some joint ventures with ADM, but I was with a different company. Part of that was even when I was the 4 years in Europe in Frankfurt, Germany, and we were looking to build a plant together either in Europe or in Asia with ADM. So I got to know the leadership, the CEO, the COO, the vice chairman very well for a couple of years working with them. I remember one day they asked me, they said, "Won't you join us at ADM?" And he said, "You got all this bureaucracy in a German company, and boy, we do things on the back of a napkin, and we do things quick." And I told him, I said, "Look, I'm 6 years with Degussa. I'm never going to leave. I'm vice president already, soon to be executive vice president, even have a chance to be the president of Degussa USA, which is a few thousand employees, plants in Mobile, Alabama." And I said, "There's no way I'm going to be leaving." Then they all made an offer, and the salary was about, with the bonus, there was about nine times with the stock options and bonus of the contract they were offering me. And I can remember telling them for an hour that there's no way I'm leaving. And I said, "Where can I sign?"
Quickly changed your tune.
Yeah, I did. Moved from Frankfurt, Germany to Decatur, Illinois ADM has 30,000 employees in Decatur and an 80,000 people town.
Wow. Little monopoly going on there. I bet there's a little nepotism going on too.
Yeah. Huge company. A great company. 30,000 people going to work doing the right thing every day. But there were four bad apples at the top that were focused on selfish leadership, not servant leadership, you know, all about themselves. I was one of those four. We had a 75-year-old CEO, 69-year-old COO, who I reported to, and me at 32. So I thought, boy, I've got three people above me. I'm number four ranked in 30,000 executives. I got three above me, and they're all double to triple my age. All I have to do is be patient. I'm either the next COO or the next CEO of ADM. Absolutely. That's where my mind was. I remember my first week, they gave me a corporate jet. The seven top executives had their own Falcon 50. So I had a corporate jet my first week. I bought the CEO's home. He lived in it for 30 years. He's 75. He wanted to move to something smaller. So my first month there, I bought his home, a 13,000 square foot home, 8-car garage. And boy, did I fill that 8-car garage with 8 cars, Ferrari, BMWs, Mercedes. I mean, I was Justin Bieber before Justin Bieber. And I really feel that, you know, we all need mentors in our lives. And I felt like I had really good mentors at DeGusa that I was really learning about things the right way. And but I tell you, when I got to a level where I was earning with bonuses, $2 or $3 million a year, I lost that moral compass. And I followed those mentors to the point where as they started reaching towards 80 years old, the CEO, about 3 years after I was there, when they saw me as part of the family and said, look, now we trust you. We're going to bring you into our inner circle. And they started sharing with me about the price fixing scheme, an international cartel they had ongoing because they had to show somebody younger. They're getting up there in age.
Right.
And I was their mentor to take over that international cartel someday. And that's when life started changing for me. It would have been 1992. 3 years with ADM, I would have been 34 then.
So Mark, when they're telling you about this, did you kind of have some red flags? It's like, I'm not so sure that this is the moral compass. Did you just bury it? Did you know that this wasn't right, but you just kind of buried that? What were you feeling at the time when they were telling you the thing?
Here's what I felt at the time. When they first brought me into it, which would have been April of 92, about 2.5 years with the company then, the vice chairman came back and he gave me a $100,000 check and 25,000 shares of stock. Together, they were worth about $1 million. A lot of my income was on performance, but a lot of the divisional president's income was on performance. Profitability, increased growth, and so on, increased revenues. But there was not anything performance related when he gave me that. I thought that's an odd time to get $1 million. He came back an hour later and I knew what it was for. That's when he said, look, Mark, we're going to start bringing you into the family. We're going to start showing you how ADM does business. We're going to have a mentor you to show you how to get involved with the price fixing of our food additives that utilized around the world. It'd be hard to find a processed food or beverage that doesn't have something ADM in, one of the largest in the world. And at that point, I asked him, I said, well, that's illegal. You can't do that. And he said, look, Mark, it's been going on for 12 years, the price fixing scheme. And he said, everybody's doing it. You can't be in the commodity business without doing this. Mm-hmm. And he said, everybody does it. And he said, Mark, it's just that the politicians that put these laws, these antitrust laws on the books, they just don't know anything about business, and these laws shouldn't even exist. And I'm listening to people 30 years my senior.
Sure.
And I'm thinking, well, that's how business is done. So I started rationalizing and said, well, they know a lot more than me. At that point, I'm 9 years out of college at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, age 34, I was 25 when I graduated. And here they're 40 years as CEO.
Right.
I thought, well, this is the way business is. I rationalized.
Right. But you had a conscience.
Yeah.
And your conscience name was Ginger.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so you're telling Ginger about this. And what did Ginger say?
Well, I'm sharing with Ginger about 7 months later when she said, something's happened these last 7 months that you're not telling me. And I started sharing with her what was going on. And this conversation ended up being hours long, several hours long conversation. And once she really understood it, and when she understood that ADM was earning an extra $1 billion a year, and that house been going on for almost 12 years, she said, Mark, we've got to expose this case. This is a massive fraud, ripping every consumer off, going to the grocery store. and you're only involved with 7 months, Mark, something that's been going on for 12 years. What a perfect time to turn yourself in.
Right.
So that's where that conversation went.
I think I remember you saying, she said, either you turn yourself in or I will.
Yes, absolutely.
And that, wow, that had taken so much courage on her part, really, Mark. But aren't you so glad?
And now I am. Back then, it was a tough ride.
It's a little tense.
But I told her then, I said, Ginger, you could be homeless. I said, this CEO is a billionaire. He's best friends with President Clinton. He's talking to Clinton on a regular basis. He's flying on President Clinton's plane. This company can come after us and destroy us. And I said, you could become homeless. And she said she'd rather be homeless than live at a home where illegal activity. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back when she said that. It was over.
Wow. Well, there's so much more I want to talk about, but we need to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Mark Whitaker.
Are you an IT executive with years of experience? Are you energized when you empower others? If I've piqued your interest thus far, you may be a great mentor for the TechLX program in St. Louis. TechLX prepares rising IT leaders to tackle today's challenges and prepare for tomorrow's demanding roles by pairing them with senior IT executives like yourself. Mentors receive coaching from technology partners and will be invited to all TechLX networking events featuring outstanding speakers of the IT industry. To apply, visit tpi.co/TLX.
So, Mark, here we are. Ginger said, this isn't right. Either you turn yourself in or I'm going to. So what happened next?
Yeah, I told Ginger, I said, Ginger, as I mentioned earlier, that she could be homeless if we turn herself in. But I tell you, she would not back down. I tried for hours to back her down. And I've known her, like I said, since the seventh grade, and I knew she wasn't going to change her mind. So the very day I'm telling Ginger, we're sitting 4 hours with the FBI. So here's this case going on for 12 years. It became the largest price-fixing case in U.S. history, close to $1 billion theft a year for 12 years in a row, started by a stay-at-home mom raising three young children. So we're sitting for 4 hours, and I never forget Ginger say, okay, my husband shared what's going on. He's only involved 7 months. We can go home now, right? And the FBI said, your husband just confessed to a $1 billion-a-year crime. He's either got to wear a wire against the kingpins or I have to arrest him today. And that's the choices I had, to either be an informant or be arrested. And that's how I became an FBI informant. So in reality, Ginger's the whistleblower and I'm the informant. And the difference between a whistleblower and informant, a whistleblower is someone that does all the right things for the right reasons and they sacrifice everything to do it, which is Ginger. And an informant is someone sitting in front of the FBI, I have a choice to be arrested or wear a wire.
And you wore a wire for 3 years.
Yes, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, all day long for 3 years.
Right. But what we've talked about, Mark, it started to wear on you. What was going on with you mentally and physically during that time?
Oh, the FBI, when they wired me up, and there's a documentary on my website on markwhitaker.com by Discovery Channel with all the real FBI agents that were part of the case and the real prosecutor and Ginger and I. And it's a very accurate portrayal of what exactly happened. And in that documentary, and just like they told me, Mark, if these guys catch you, they're going to kill you. And to hear that, you know, if you get caught wearing a wire, you could end up dead. I tell you, I lost 60 pounds. People at work thought I had cancer. I sleep in 2 or 3 hours a night. I was falling apart. I literally was having a nervous breakdown to the point where Ginger tried to beg to the FBI to have me hospitalized, but they were afraid if I was hospitalized, the doctor would say, this guy can't wear a wire anymore because he's falling apart. And so they wouldn't allow it. So I was not allowed to see any kind of health care those 3 years during that time.
Oh, had to have been horrific. Your physical body suffered from it, your mental, your emotional, all of that. But what ended up happening, though, is that they did have a case then after you wore this wire, right? Because you were still invited into the inner circle. So they had all of this evidence. You ended up going to prison, too, but it wasn't for that.
Well, during this time, especially after a couple years, I'm wearing a wire, and they're telling me their last few months were kind of coming to an end. And I start thinking, reality, who is going to hire someone wore wire for 3 years against their own company? It would be easier to get a job as a felon than someone wore a wire for 3 years. I mean, it was going to be impossible. Here at that point, I'm only 38 years old, wearing a wire for 3 years. And I thought, how am I going to keep that home, the horse riding stable, the arena and everything we had at that property. And I was addicted. I was really obsessed with that lifestyle. I never used drugs or alcohol, but I know what addiction is. I had a greed addiction. And I thought, how am I going to keep up with that? And I had all these millions of dollars of stock options that was about a year away from exercising, but the case was going to go public, which means I was going to be kicked out, fired before I could exercise them. When I calculated, I sold $9 million that they would owe me if this case never happened, you know, like a year down the road based on that stock price. And I thought, there is no way I'm going to keep that $9 million on the table. I risked my life for the FBI. They've told me that every day. There's no way I was going to leave it on the table. So I wrote 5 checks to myself that equated to that $9 million. And I ended up going to prison for that, when the others went to prison for price fixing. And I thought my stock options would be a defense, but I learned legally you cannot exercise them a year early.
Yeah. So that did lead you to prison. You would spend 9 years in federal prison. What was the stat that you told me? Because Ginger was so faithful to you during that time. She like came wherever you, because you were in a couple of different prisons, right?
Yes. With good behavior in a white collar camps, with good behavior, you move to a better place. So I started off at Mississippi. Ginger and my kids moved there. Good behavior got me put to Edgefield, South Carolina. Ginger and my kids moved there. They came every Friday evening and all day Saturday and all day Sunday in a visiting room setting, because that's when the families are allowed to come in, 20 hours a weekend. And then my last 5 years, the FBI helped me get to Pensacola, Florida Navy base, and Ginger moved there. So I was on a Navy base the last 5 years, which you have to have some government support, like CIA or FBI, and the FBI got me there for all my cooperation. And they're even trying to get me a pardon today. All my agents, prosecutor and 2 judges are pushing for a presidential pardon, more so now than ever, because they saw the sacrifices I did wearing a wire. They said he had plenty of punishment for what he did wrong, but we never gave him credit for what he did right.
Yeah. Ginger stuck with you.
Exactly.
What's the stat that you gave me? It's 78% that go past 5 years actually end up in divorce. Is that correct?
If you're incarcerated, the divorce rate's 78%. If you serve 5 years and longer, and I did 8.5, 5 years and longer is a 99% divorce rate. And we're married 41 years. Miracle of God.
Absolutely. Well, there's another miracle of God that happened. A gentleman came into your life when you were in prison by the name of Chuck Colson, and you consider him to be one of your greatest mentors. And you had a transformation that happened, Mark. You surrendered your life to Jesus. And I want you to tell about that.
I got offered a 6-month plea agreement, 6 months. Even with the $9 million fraud, they offered me 6 months for all my cooperation. My lawyer calls me in Chicago, says, Mark, 6 months in prison is a deal of a lifetime. You lost your immunity agreement with this $9 million fraud. And Ginger said, Mark, I beg you to sign it. And I looked at Ginger and I said, Ginger, you're the reason why I'm in this mess in the first place. I took this 6-month plea agreement. I would have had a Martha Stewart sentence. And I ripped it up in front of her and said, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to go to court. And I ended up going to court system for 3 years to get 8.5 years instead. And the amazing thing is, people were reading about that in the newspaper. There was a guy read about it from CBMC, a guy named Ian Howes. And I was so depressed, I tried to take my own life. I thought, I can't do 8.5 years in prison. So I tried to kill myself. And that really became front page of the media newspapers at the time, USA Today, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, and so on. And so Ian Howes read that in the paper and reached out to me from CBMC, from a group called Christian Businessmen Connection. And he started introducing me to God. And at that time, after 8 years of college in biochemistry, all I learned in science was Big Bang Theory, Darwinism. I remember a professor saying, if you believe in God, you can't be a scientist. That was a block for me. And so he started pouring into me. And then my second week in prison, another man reached out named Chuck Colson, who was the White House counsel under President Nixon in his 30s, had an office next to the Oval Office, went to prison for the Watergate scandal. President Nixon would have had also, but President Ford pardoned him. So President Nixon didn't go to prison for that reason. But Chuck Colson went to prison and he became a Christian in the 70s during that journey. So he read about me in the paper and he saw a lot of himself in my story. And he reached out my second week. So between Ian Howes and Chuck Colson discipling me and mentoring me, for the first time in my life, I'm seeing real servant leaders surrender my life to Jesus, literally my third month in prison in June of 98 at age 40.
Oh, and we didn't talk about this piece, but I know that you ended up going on to lead several other people to Christ during your time. So God took that situation and there was purpose and good that came out of it. But do you remember, what was it about Chuck?
Oh,
because
yes.
Reconciling science with faith is sometimes really hard for people.
I mean, he was like a father to me and poured 15 years into me, not long even in prison, but even when I got out 15 years ago in 06, he didn't pass till 2012. He actually passed out on stage giving his testimony. So he was working right up to the point when he passed away. I remember telling him about Ian House. I told him about how I'm being discipled. And I'm learning about Jesus, but the block is the science. And he said, Mark, you don't think there's a PhD scientist that believes in God? And I said, no, I don't. And he started sharing me article after article and book after book. And some of the most prominent scientists that I knew their names, but I didn't know they were Christians. And I started reading all these books. And even Albert Einstein, he sent me an article. And Albert Einstein said the Big Bang Theory is impossible. Only God could create the earth and God could create man. And I'm thinking, well, Albert Einstein's a pretty smart guy. There are dozens of articles and books like that, to the point where I thought, well, how can you be a scientist and not believe in God?
Yeah. What a mentor. Okay, so let's move on here. So you got out of prison. I know that you spent some time with a company that does cancer research. You spent quite a long time there, I think, 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, about a decade, yes.
Doing amazing, amazing things. And as you and I had said, you felt like that was a miracle because you were like, who's going to hire a felon? That job opened up for you, and I know you did great things when you were there. But I want to move forward to what you're doing today, and I want you to tell our listeners about that. We're going to talk about something extra, and then unfortunately, we'll be out of time.
Well, just a real quick footnote, when I was in prison, I helped guys get their GEDs, learn how to read, learn how to write. And I'm telling you something, Lisa, that's the first time in my life I experienced servant leadership. Here I was making $2 or $3 million for a year for 8 years, and now I'm making $20 a month for 8.5 years. And it filled that void. I found how rewarding it was to serve. Yeah, because I'd never done that until prior to Chuck Colson and Ian Howes, really prior to accepting God into my life and accepting Jesus. It changed me. And I found how rewarding that was. It's almost like I became a free man in prison. So Cornell started, some of those professors became Christians. They were reading about me in the newspaper and they started visiting me in prison, and they brought pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies to visit me. And I had 4 offers the day I got out of prison from the biotech and pharmaceutical industry.
Well, you know what? Your brains were always there, Mark. You're an incredibly smart, intelligent man. There's no doubt about that. You don't get a PhD at the age that you did, you know, started your PhD when you're 22 years old and not be incredibly intelligent. But now you had a character maybe that matched that intelligence because of what Jesus had done in your life.
Yeah, more maturity and more about others than myself. And I chose this particular company because of a Christian CEO called Cypress Biotech. I started off someone like right out of college. I became the COO, the number two executive of that company over a decade. It's still on the advisory board even today.
Yeah, so you did that. And then pivoting to what you're doing today, you're under the umbrella of Coke Consolidated, which a lot of people may not know about Coke Consolidated. They know about Coca-Cola.
Well, there's two parts of Coke. You know, Coca-Cola is in Atlanta, kind of the parent company. But then Coke Consolidated is a separate company, different CEO, different board. And we're the largest bottler in the United States. Kind of the distribution, fulfillment, bottling side. 102 plants. $5 billion in revenues. We're a public company on the NASDAQ. And our purpose statement, you see it on our invoices. When we hire people, they see it on their pay stubs. You see it on our entire wall of our headquarters. Our purpose statement is our only purpose, to honor God in all we do. I mean, it's an amazing company. Chaplains in all of our plants.
Yeah.
It's a very servant leadership oriented company.
Yes. And we've talked a little bit about that. I can't wait to at some point meet Frank.
Oh, he's an amazing guy.
But there's an initiative under this. And now with T-Factor, you're teaching other companies how to do something similar, right?
Yes, I lead the T-Factor initiative. I'm the executive director. And it's where we equip other CEOs and senior leaders, companies around the world. We have people from Europe, Mexico, Africa, and we do these every couple of months, and we equip them how to have a purpose-driven servant leadership culture. And we share our Coke journey that we've been doing. We're a 118-year-old company. Our CEO has taken us this direction 22 years ago, kind of a purpose-driven, faith-based direction. And we share that journey with other CEOs and senior leaders at T-Factor.
Yeah, I just love that. And it's going to be so fun to see how companies, you know, may just be turned upside down by what you guys are doing there. But this is called Something Extra. So, Mark, I'd love for you to tell me, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs? And there's lots of something extras.
I tell you what I see and what I really learned in this 22-year journey when my own life was transformed at age 40. What I see in those is relationship versus transactional. When I was at ADM in my 30s, it was all about these 4,000 people in the biotech division. How can they help me move up the corporate ladder? Very transactional. Hey, I'll give you a higher income. I'll give you a higher bonus if you do this, this, and that. You know, very transactional. Now I've learned through this 22-year journey of servant leadership of relational. Relational trumps transactional. And it is the longer-term way to serve. And servant leaders, to me, what makes a servant leader is when they're relational instead of transactional.
Mm-hmm. So how does that flesh out in a day in the life of Mark Whitaker? Having that servant leadership mindset, what does that mean to you? How does that look?
Yeah, it means that you really care and you really take the time to care. When I was at ADM in my 30s, it's how can that group of people, those 30,000 employees, help me move up the corporate ladder? It really means reversing that. How can I make their lives better? What can I do in their life to make their life better by really serving them? And that's what I found at in prison by helping with them get the GEDs and learn how to read and learn how to write, how rewarding that was. And when you are relational and you really care about people, and even when you find out they're not performing as well as you think they should, but you find out what's going on in their life, maybe a husband that has cancer or financial problems or a spouse laid off because of COVID, when you find out the details, then you can understand why they're not maybe performing as well as they should. By helping that resolve that and being there for them makes a world of difference. The people around you, then they perform and they perform well and they want to perform.
Right. There's a scripture that says, you know, think about others more than yourself. It's very countercultural.
Yeah.
That's not how we, you know, from a worldly perspective, we're brought up. It's like, you better take care of you.
Yeah.
But really, that's empty. You had it all.
I really did. I think I could have got to the level of Bill Gates and I still would have been asking, there's got to be something more than this at that stage in my 30s.
Yeah. How exhausting too, right, Mark?
Yeah.
That's exhausting that it's never enough.
Absolutely.
So, well, this has just been so much fun. So I want to give you the opportunity to tell our audience, because I know that you have a summit coming up.
That's right.
So tell our listeners if they say, wow, I want to know more about this T-Factor. How can you get involved?
Yeah, there's two things I want to mention. I want to mention Ginger was doing an interview on CBS News and they asked her, what would have happened if your husband signed that 6-month sentence? Ginger, right prior to that, she said, you know what? Divorce wasn't an option. Her faith wouldn't allow it. Even though she wanted to run, she said, but she said murder was an option. She wanted to kill him. And they asked her when she was the most mad. It's when I took that 6-month plea agreement. And then they asked Ginger, this would have been in 2009, what would have happened if I did that 6-month sentence? Ginger said, I think my husband would have came out the same greedy man. He went in, God gave exactly what he needed, which was 8.5 years in prison. Become, you know, the man that God.
The man that he is, right, that he intended for you to be.
I want to share that. I think that's important.
I think that's important too, Mark, because that certainly is not a fun time. But God knows what we need.
Right.
He knows what needs to happen in our life to make us who he intended for us to be. Right. And sometimes it's those struggles. And certainly he did a transformation on you. And now you and Ginger just celebrated your 41st wedding anniversary. And that may not have happened because you would have been the same guy.
Yeah. I think I would have lost my family if I became the COO of ADM. And this may have saved my family.
That's right.
And it also brought me to God with brokenness. So sometimes brokenness is not a bad thing. I had to be broken.
Absolutely.
That's how I got to know God and would listen to people like Chuck Olson. Now being T-Factor is where we actually help equip ones to become servant leaders. And they can go to our website, tfactor.com. And it's Coca-Cola Consolidated's initiative. how we equip leaders to integrate their faith in their work and transform their cultures to purpose-driven servant leadership cultures. And we're seeing cultures all around the world are adding some of the things that we're sharing, and we see their companies being transformed. We'd love to have them.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I know how busy you are, and so I'm just completely humbled that you made the time, and I know that your story is going to help our listeners. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.